I was on a live stream. I've never been on the show. It's an honor.
I remember we set up a Twitch stream and you popped on from France.
I remember the date. It was January 6th.
Really?
Yes, it was.
The day before.
Yes, it was. Wow. I think I had a little bit too much to drink and I was mixing it up with Matt Christman.
Right. Oh, that sounds about right. Yeah.
But you were very polite to me, even though I made a fool of myself, as per usual.
What the hell are you talking about? What could you possibly... You're our France correspondent. And we don't trust in you to give us, like, the straight dope on what's happening in Europe.
Oh, yeah.
We trust.
Now, we normally like to get, you know, if we're going to have someone report on France or Germany or Italy, we like to get a native, but... We've had a lot of European guests on, and some of them are a little bit hard to understand. So,
damn, shots fired.
I'm glad that we've, you know, it's they know it too.
Your Henry's an expatriate.
Yeah,
right?
So I'm an expatriate. I'm almost French. I'll be, God willing, I'll be French in the next year or so.
You'll become a revolutionary. You'll have you'll be part of the Fifth Republic then.
Yeah, and they're gonna throw me out like old Tom Paine.
Yeah, do you think an election of Marine Le Pen might harm your chances of getting citizenship, or are you one of the good ones?
Well, Jordan, the thing with Jordan Bardella is, like, part of his rhetoric about immigration is, you know, if you're one of the good ones, as you say, you have nothing to fear from us. But, like, what does it mean to be one of the good ones? It means you're not unemployed for 6 months, right? So, like, if something happened in the economy and there was a downturn, I could go from a good one to a bad one, you know?
I see.
Oh, that's a good point. It's like, I read it in the paper today. He was saying, Bardella, is that his name? Jordan Bardella? He's like...
Yeah, Jordan Bardella. Yeah.
Like the 28-year-old, like, photogenic fascist guy. Or, like, post-fascist dude. I was like, if you're work and you pay your taxes and you live by the code of the French, you're okay.
Yeah.
But you're a comic, so like where
does that's a problem. That's a problem. I mean, to be honest with you, like as a white man and the father of a blue-eyed, blonde-haired kid, I'm not exactly number one on their hit list. But at the end of the day, their whole program, like you can't just, even if you want to select, okay, only the bad immigrants, we all have to go through the immigration system. Like I've stood in the lines. You know, I know I've stood in the lines for 6-8 hours. You know what I mean? And
the French don't even like lines. The Germans love them, but the French.
The Germans love lines.
Yeah. You queued up along with the rest of the Grenouilles.
Yeah, I just came actually from a march. I would say there's probably 15,000 people in the street today. Yesterday, I was at a march in a different, smaller town that was 300 people. And then last week, I would say we probably had, I want to say 3,000 people. So the numbers are pretty variable right now, but the movement is strong. And I mean, folks are going on strike. It's a pretty big mobilization, I'd say.
And this is in the rural south of France is where you're based?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm rural, but I'm certainly in the home of the, you know, Marine Le Pen and Eric Ciotti, who we can talk about. Have you guys seen what happened with Eric Ciotti?
No, I don't know anything about him. Is he is not a French unbowed? He is like a
bowed. No. He is the head of the Les Républicains, which is like the French normal right wing party.
Oh, the Sarkozy. And, the Sarkozy party, right.
Exactly. And after the European elections where the RN completely trounced, and RN is Le Pen's party, the Rassemblement National, the National Rally. I'm gonna have an article published here shortly that goes through all these like groups and stuff and gives an overview if people want to catch up on the acronyms. But after the RN had their landslide, Eric Ciotti came out and he broke the Republican pact, folks. And he was like, actually, we should just team up with the far right.
Oh, and right. Cordon sanitaire. He came out.
Yeah, it was broken. And the political direction committee, like the committee that runs the Republican Party, was like, no, you can't do that. We're throwing you out. And he's like, no, you can't throw me out. I'm staying put in the office. I'm staying in my chair. And, you know, the old candidate, Valérie Pécresse, had to come up and roll up her sleeves and come like, I'm going to haul him out of the office. It was crazy.
I saw the footage. She like had a spare key and she like busted.
Exactly.
Locked himself in like that meme. They're like, don't form an alliance with the fascists. Don't form an alliance with the fascists. And he's inside.
No.
You have to.
And he came back the next day and he did it again. Wow. And I think there's some kind of the court, the like French judiciary is deciding whether or not he can actually be tossed out. I'm not following every blow by blow of this conflict, but like you have among the sort of Republican, right? And we can talk about Republican. Do you think the audience knows what Republican means, Andy?
You might want to explain it in the French context.
Do you mind, Sean, Andy, do you mind if I just do like a right to left political party overview?
Yeah, no, well, I
let's,
think that's
let's
great.
Start out by saying we're going to be, there's an election in France. The first round is on June 30th, I think.
Yeah.
And as of right now, the national rally, Le Pen's fascist party, is in the lead. But the left parties, all of the major ones, I think, have joined an alliance called the Front Populaire.
The Popular Front.
Which has
the new Popular Front.
Historical significance. And it looks like Macron's strategy here to reestablish his legitimacy through the snap elections is going to be a huge failure. And so we're going to try to go through what's going on with this sort of realignment moment in France and what the election might look like and its broader significance. So with that said, take us through the spectrum.
Yeah. So I'll give a sort of overview of what's happened in the electoral scene post COVID. And I am not an electoral expert. I'm not like a pollster. I'm not a political scientist. I'm a engineer and a union man and a member of the CGT and somebody that goes out and tries to get stuff done. So if I make a mistake, feel free to tear me a new one in the comments.
But basically, best fact checkers out there, man. I don't think many people out there really know much about Renewy politics. And if they do, they can keep their mouth shut because you're just a worker. You're just a guy. Do your thing.
I'm just as a worker. What I'd like to say is that we had a pretty large social contestation before COVID with the yellow vests. And things were really good. I mean, I remember days where I was just trying to pick up a guy from the airport. And, you know, I met him at the main train station in central Paris. And we were walking around looking for a bite to eat. And there were just cars in front fire in front of the opera. We were like, is the president going to flee the country? I don't know. You know, and, you know, it was a huge, I mean, it was probably the most intense, significant social movement I've ever been a part of was the yellow vest. It was huge. And then with COVID, Macron and the center had a kind of reprieve where they had an excuse to like, hey, you can work, you can shop, and you can stay inside. You know, that's what you can do. And so after that, like following that whole time, there was this election, actually in the middle of the whole COVID period, where Macron came up against Jean-Luc Mélenchon of the left party, and then the France Insoumise, the France Unbowed, and the NUPES, the New Union for a Social and Ecological People's Front or something like that. I don't know how exactly to translate it.
That is
a long acronym.
Yeah.
And he barely lost the ability to go to the second round. So the second round was Marie Le Pen of the far right. And just for people that know, when I say the far right, I'm not doing the kind of American liberal bullshit maneuver where I say everything I don't like is fascist. Mm. The National Rally, formerly the National Front, was founded by literal members of the Waffen-SS. Marie Le Pen's ancestor, Jean-Marie Le Pen, he, you know, has been condemned up into the 2000s of Holocaust denial. Members of the party today have relations with far-right fascist militias. I mean, people that they're running right now, when I talk about connections, I'm talking about folks have been implicated in national scandals about, like, funding ISIS. Like, shit is insane. It's an insane party. It's a crazy party. And their program, I mean, we can talk about it later if you want, but it's a very, you know, it's a neo-fascist party, as we say in French. So I would classify it as neo-fascist. And I'm not somebody that throws the term fascist around willy-nilly, right? But basically what happened was Marie Le Pen versus Macron. And something that, you know, Macron is the sort of heart and soul of neoliberalism, as my friend put it, he refused to run on his record. And he basically said, it's me or the fascists. And so he won against the fascists and he won a second mandate. But in France, you know, we have a presidential system and a parliament. And we also have the European Parliament. And in the recent European parliamentary elections, Macron's centrist party collapsed. The far right National Rally Party gained a huge number of seats and support. And some of the left parties also had a, you know, an uptick. So it was basically the left and the far right and the center and the center right collapsing, right? And for whatever reason, we can talk about my theories later if you want, Macron decided to dissolve the parliament, call for snap elections with basically no time, which is really, people need to understand this. However you feel about democracy, this is fundamentally an anti-democratic measure to say, hey, we're going to have a parliament in like a month. Mm. That's not enough time to run a campaign. People are going, like right now, I live, you know, very close to the beach, folks. come visit me, hang out at the Sand if you want to, you know. But the matter is, like, folks are on vacation. Folks are starting to go on vacation. This is not, you can't run a political campaign in 3 weeks. That's not real.
Yeah, you know, so, in the United States, we do it over the course of 2 years.
Right.
Because we love democracy that much.
We love it so
much. Put a pin in that, and we can come back to Bordiga's critique of the original Popular Front later. Yeah. So basically, overnight, the left got over their bullshit and called a new Popular Front. It was mostly pushed by people that come from social movements like Le Nuit Debout that happened before COVID, and, you know, the CGT and the other sort of like strong unions, and what I would say the good NGOs, like the NGO, like the people that, you know, fight for human rights and like the LGBT equality,
like the Sans Papier movements and stuff like that.
Yeah, all that stuff, you know, and also like the sort of normal NGOs like ATTAC and the other people that are, you know, like the sort of the left that actually has a base was all like the electoralists. You have to get your shit together because the stakes are too high. And so in a matter of days, and remember, the Noops coalition took a long time to get together and stuff. This Popular Front emerged in a matter of literal days, and it came out. It has a strong platform. People can read the platform, but we're talking about everything from ecological stuff, like no new freeways and highways, to a stop to these kind of like water projects that poison water sources and agricultural areas, which has been a major focus of the sort of land occupation movement. We can talk about later, Andy, if you want. That's linked to the ZOD and other things like that, all the way to retirement at 60 years, raise the minimum wage, peg salaries to inflation, which, as Sean knows, the U.S. exported its recession to Europe. Mm-hmm. So a lot of folks have been really struggling to make ends meet, right? So everybody would basically get a raise if the new Popular Front wins, right? And I mean, we can go all the like menstrual leave. There's all kinds of aspects of the platform that I think are objectively good reforms. Menstrual and as somebody leave? Who does participate in a labor union, I think, you know, our great grandfathers and grandmothers and everybody fought for 40 hours a week and blah, blah, blah. And there's a real chance that, like, in my workplace, we could get to 4 days a week.
Wow.
You know, in a Popular Front government, we could get to all kinds of benefits. And I think those are real. Like, I think that matters, you know. And there's also a possibility of making a new fucking constitution. Like, we could have a new constitution, a new republic come out of this.
Republic? This might be
a sixth republic.
Wow.
The good one.
A good one. The communist republic.
No, but I mean, we can talk about later the stakes of what's in play, but it's not just a matter of like, I hate Trump. I don't want Trump to be president. So I'm going to vote for Biden, who reincarnates a bunch of Trump's policies in like a liberal frame. Like, the difference between immigration law under the Popular Front and under the National Rally is huge. Mm. Like, the Popular Front is like, we're going to give basically amnesty to a bunch of illegal immigrants or undocumented or whatever you want to say, and give them papers. Like, that's huge. The sans-papiers having papers would be huge for them. I mean, I know people like this, right? Guys that go to work and then they get juked by the boss and they don't ever get paid. That can't happen if they're actually fully papered, right? So, like, for a lot of people, this could be a huge difference in terms of what comes out of it. And now, is everything in the platform going to get done? No, but I mean, that's part of electoralism. If you're going to accept any kind of electoral interaction, that's what you're going to accept. Am I off base? Am I being too electoralist?
No.
This is Antifada?
No, this is all good. We're not exactly anti-electoralists. We just like to understand what's going on and...
Like, I didn't vote for Bernie Sanders. I'll say that right now. I didn't vote whatsoever until I think I voted in for Obama, and then I have been abstentionist in U.S. politics since. I'm not an electoralist.
We like to focus our attention elsewhere because it gets a lot less coverage. This episode here confronts Andy and I and all the listeners who are probably broadly aligned with what we believe with an interesting test case of like, what is it? What do you do if you believe the things that we believe about capitalist democracy, about the value, whatever it is, but yeah. You're facing a situation like you're faced right now in France, where like,
I share the critique and like to go to the heart of it. If you read like, what did Bordiga say about the original Popular Front, right? The idea is that it wastes time. It takes up all people's energy, even stuff like occupying the factories. He was like, this is a waste of time. We need to seize power right now.
Right.
That was his argument.
And he was
running, whatever you think of it, that was his argument.
He was running at a time when the left was the majority, and now we're looking, or at least like pose the potential of winning the majority, or just winning power. through direct action. Now we're at a moment where the left has unified in France, but it does, to me, just looking at the polls, it looks like there's something of a ceiling on their support, where they're around 28%. National Rally is around 33%. And it seems like the question is, where will undecideds break? And it just, you know, from a vulgar reading of it, it seems like there's more potential for the liberals and the traditional right, the center left and the center right, to break towards the National Rally than break towards the left.
Well, let me finish. Let me close this little brief excursus into Bordiga and then go back to the survey of the history. Yeah. Right?
I'm just glad it didn't take too long to get back to Bordiga. This is exciting.
I have a lot of alignment with you guys. You know that, right? Like, I am not, like, as I was saying a minute ago, I'm not electoralist. One of the reasons I'm not in the DSA and I'm not a Bernie-crat is because I think a lot of it is a waste of time, right?
And also, you live in France.
Also, I live in France. But, like, even when I was in the U.S., I was not doing that stuff.
Well, this is, like I said, an interesting test case, because if we were sitting here and we were facing an election where it wasn't, like, a bumbling, like, dipshit like Donald Trump and everything that he represents, but, like, a truly, like, odious fascist figure, like, yeah. I can't think of one in the United States. If that election was up, you know, who knows which way we would go on it. We'd all have to make our personal decision, but it would be important for us to talk it over. So this is a good...
I think it's an ethical... I'll say this right now. There's an ethical imperative for people of goodwill, not only to stop the far right from coming to power, but also to support an objectively good program. There's nothing in this program that's making me like, what is this bullshit? You know, like... Everything in the program, more or less. I mean, maybe there's some point that somebody's going to dig up and say, this is sus. But, like, do you want to retire at 60, Sean, or not?
I mean, I retire at 55 in my local, but I would, if I had to, I'd take 60 years old. Sure, that'd be fine.
Between, like, 60 and 65, right? Would you take 5 years off your retirement or not?
Oh, absolutely. And an extra day off. And the legalization of the sans-papier, if you think about the way that capital, not just in France, but in the United States, Germany, China, everywhere, uses one part of the working class as a cudgel against the other, to end that process would be a huge victory for the working class, maybe a nationally bounded victory, but one that is, you know, you could work with.
And I think it's also important to note that part of the reason we got to this point in France where there is a more explicitly left politics within shooting distance of power is because of the collapse of the Socialist Party, who had kept this kind of coalition building, this kind of explicitly left or working class movement at bay for so long.
I think we're getting ahead of ourselves. We haven't even, like, named all the names, right?
Let's be patient. So, the French are known for their patience.
For their patience. So we go from right to left, right? So in the far right, we have Eric Zemmour and Marianne Maréchal Le Pen, although I think she's been excluded from the party now for proposing an alliance with the RN. And the Reconquista Party.
Oh,
I think that tells you everything you need to know about them. Now, for the leftists who are listening, who have a sense of history, remember that Zemmour often speaks very well of Georges Marchais. Do you all know who is Georges Marchais or not?
I do not.
No. I know Zemmour is a pied noir, right? So he's still living the battles of the 60s and 70s.
Well, in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, the head of the French Communist Party, the PCF, was a man named Georges Marchais, who was, you know, a worker and come up through those kind of that cadre system, that institutional system. And he did, you know, he's not lying. Mm. In some respects, he does. And so there is an issue that we need to think about of, like, Zemmour in the far right has objectively taken a part of the base of the left with them.
Mm-hmm.
They do objectively have that. And I've seen some, like, French commentators say, like, no, people that vote for the far right were never workers. That's bullshit. I can tell you from firsthand experience, I know workers who have voted for the far right in this election. So Zemmour represents the most extreme far right position, right?
And he's like a that's Tucker the Reconquista Carlson Party type figure, right? He's like a far right troll TV personality.
He was like a Tucker Carlson, like, right? But, like, more extreme, who then got into politics. That's how I understand.
Or like Nigel Farage, right?
Nigel Farage, yeah.
Yeah. Like, he represents kind of the idea of Nigel Farage, of this sort of, like, extreme far right guy that you can bring on TV and everybody laughs at, but also it represents an actually threatening view of the country. I mean, Reconquista, what more do I need to say? He's like the pole of anti-Islamic, blah, 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 blah. Right.
Yeah. And
then you have,
I want to go to Farage a little bit later and compare it to, there's a similar election happening in the UK. But when we're talking about, like, workers voting for the National Rally, the typical left thing to say is that, well, Macron doesn't put anything on the table for workers, and Le Pen claims to.
Yeah.
Do you see that sort of getting deflated now, that there is this very pro-working class platform proposed by the unified left?
Well, since you've asked me this question, I will take another parenthesis, and I will say that I'm very proud of some of our European left leaders, even the electoral leaders. And remember, I'm not an electoralist fundamentally, like especially the women leaders like Li Andersson in Finland. Her party did very well in the European elections. And Sophie Binet, head of the CGT, who have been very clear in all of their propaganda saying the RN claims to have all this like social backing, right? They claim to be in support of the workers, but they're objectively not. Mm. They're in league with the bosses and they are aiming their politics directly at you, right? They're coming for you and they're coming for your working conditions, et cetera, et cetera. So part of the Popular Front is trying to negate this, you know, and we'll talk about this in a minute. This is actually also poses a problem, right? A problem of maybe like react, like some reactionary politics coming into the left. But the Popular Front is very explicitly trying to get working class voters from the far right to come back to the left, electorally speaking. Does that make sense, Andrew?
Yeah, I'm just asking how it, if you see it working.
I think it could work. I mean, the thing is, we don't act like the thing with polls, right? Is polls are kind of bullshit to begin with. Polls are a little bit pseudoscientific in general. Like you call a bunch of old people, you call like 5,000 old people on the phone because that's who answers on landlines, right? And you ask them a question and then you're like, this represents, it doesn't actually represent anything, right?
I remember so polls are kind of 2016, all right? You don't have to convince Americans that polls can be really wrong.
I won a bunch of money on 2016, by the way.
Oh, attaboy, way to go.
But that's right.
Our loss is your gain.
Have the
exactly.
polls for French elections been similarly far off?
I don't know that they've been like far off. It's just when you have so little time for a campaign, like I what I'm telling you is that I get all of the emails, I get all of the messages, I follow all of the propaganda, I see all of the tracts that people literally hand out, right? The other day we had the Festival de la Musique and there were people from La France Insoumise and the CGT out there handing out tracts to people, okay? I saw some old ladies that I don't want that tract, but most people took the tract. And in the tract, it clearly denounced the far right as people who are not actually in favor of the working class, right? So it's very possible that this propaganda will have an effect, but we won't know that. I mean, we're going to have a fucking election next week.
Yeah.
That's, you know what I mean?
Thursday.
So we're like, no, I think it's a Sunday.
Sunday. That's very democratic.
Unlike in America. Yeah. We actually have it on a week in a weekend, you know?
Smart.
But anyway, continuing from the right, and we'll go back to your question, Andy, if I didn't answer it correctly.
Oh, sure.
So we have the Reconquista Party. Then we have the Rassemblement National, the National Rally, formerly the National Front. And remember, again, I cannot emphasize this enough. It wasn't just one guy. Multiple collaborators, not just collaborators, but literal members of the Waffen-SS, like Charlemagne Division or whatever, founded this party. This is a party of fascism. Fundamentally, it's been a party of fascism consistently, and it's a party of neo-fascism today. If you link to my article, I'll link from the article to some French resources that people can like Google Translate talking about this. Like people that are literally running for election, even if they're like a substitute or whatever, these are guys going around meeting with fascist paramilitaries and gangs. Okay. So again, I don't like calling everything I don't like fascist. I think that's corny. This is actually fascist.
Would you say it's more or less fascist than Meloni's party in Italy, which has similar origins?
I'm not an expert on an Italian situation. I don't want to comment.
Okay.
It'll be interesting towards the end of this or in the middle. I don't know how we'll end up on this to surmise how Marine Le Pen's party might govern, because Meloni is governed as like a center rightist, essentially. And I know that
the issue is that I can answer that right now.
Yeah.
If the RN, like let's say the RN has a huge victory and they come to an absolute majority, which I don't think is probable, but let's say it does happen, then they will have to do what's called a cohabitation with Macron. Mm. That means that Macron remains in a position of strong power over the parliament, because people have to remember that the current French Republic is somewhat anti-democratic in its constitution. That is, it has a much stronger presidential aspect than most other European countries. So in most European countries, if you win the parliament, you win power. In France, it's not the case. You have to share power significantly with the president. So even if Jordan Bardella and Marie Le Pen's party comes to power in the parliament, they still have to govern with Macron. Really, what's troubling long term, if we take the long view of things, if we zoom out, what's troubling is this normalization of the far right. Right. I was talking to a woman today at the protest who told me that her whole life she's been making barrage. She's been making a kind of wall, a dam against the far right. She voted for Jacques Chirac, even though she's a socialist, because Jacques Chirac was the opponent of the far right in his day, right? And she was sick of constantly voting against the far right. And she's happy that with the Popular Front, she has something to vote for. And she's sick of thinking about the center right and being in a coalition with the center right and basically saying, like, I'm more interested. And again, this is a woman, a teacher, in appealing to the working class voters in the far right to get them to come over to our side than trying to appeal to the center right. That was her position, right? As a native born French, she's been here her whole life. So again, it's a matter of, I think we should continue the parties, because I think if we talk about stuff without talking about all the parties, it's going to be confusing to the listener. So we have the national rally, which I've talked about. Then after the national rally, you have Les Républicains. Les Républicains is the Gaullist party. So this is the right that was resistant against fascism. It's sort of its origin story, its mythos, right?
From Charles de Gaulle.
And this is Charles de Gaulle, right, who was a member of the French resistance. He went abroad, et cetera, et cetera. He took Simone Weil's Need for Roots and put it in a drawer and came up with the worst constitution. So, you know,
he saw it as necessary because of what they saw as the chaos of parliament under the last republic, right? So the Fifth Republic and the strong presidential position is an attempt to try to, like, keep the chaos of parliament at bay, right?
Right.
So it's legacy all around.
So the Republican Party is really what we would consider the Democratic Party in the U.S. to be, in the sense of it's the party of the bourgeoisie, right? It's the party of the bosses. It's the party of those people who are, like, Catholic in a nominal sense. So they, like, you know, like, in France, the concept of Catholic is actually very interesting. Like, to be Catholic in France means, like, I support French traditions in a vague and unspecified way, right? And then the people that are, like, actually Catholic, like, I know a lot of people on the sort of religious side who are actually going to church, who are out, you know, protesting with the Popular Front, right? But there's a way in which, like, you can be nominally Catholic as part of your conservatism and, you know, have your mistress too, right? So that's kind of Le Républicain, you know? And Le Républicain right now is in the middle of fracturing. So we already talked about Eric Ciotti, who has decided to make an alliance with the far right. There are people who are basically the kind of institutionalists within the Républicain who say, no, we will not go with the far right and we will not unite with the left or the center. We're going to maintain our own pole, who are basically like sectarians, essentially. And then you have people like the former prime minister Villepin, who said, you know, if it comes to it, I call on everybody to support the Popular Front against the far right. And that's kind of like the sort of integrity position within the Républicain, who say, you know, like, actually the values of the Republic matter. And we're, you know, we actually care about what we're supposed to care about. And I do respect that to a degree, even though obviously I disagree with Villepin in politics. There's a degree into which the sort of Républicain orientation does mean something. And if I can kind of make it simple for the listener, when somebody in French politics claims to be Républicain, it basically means like, I'm a good person. It means like, I don't support the extremes, you know? So there's a Républicain right, but people like Villepin, and there's a Républicain left. And then one of the big questions on the left is like, do we actually care about this category of Républicain or not? Right? So and a lot of people would piss on it.
The Republicans as Gaullists are similar to like Peronists in Argentina, right? Like it's like this pole of like a mid-20th century sort of like dirigist politics that like claims to value the Republic in the same way that like Democrats claim to value the Constitution against the norm breaking of.
Exactly. To put it simply, like if I can rush ahead in the elaboration of the parties, you have to remember that the Socialist Party is the SFIO. It's the Second International, right? The Communist Party, the PCF, is the Third International. We also have parties of the Fourth International and all the weird Trotskyist internationals.
That's right? Andy's favorite international.
Andy's a big Trotsky fan. I know.
No, he's more like a Trotsky spotter. He's a Trot spotter.
Yeah. He's a Trot spotter.
But most of those parties are out of the Popular Front, right? Like they wouldn't join it.
Well, it's weird about the Popular Front. Okay, so now you guys keep insisting that I skip ahead, so which I will indulge.
That's the plan.
Because I'm tired.
I know.
I've been marching all night. I already had Campari. Now I'm drinking wine. So you've got me.
In typical Grenouille fashion. Go on.
In official Grenouille fashion. But the thing is, like, some of the Trotskyists support the Popular Front. Some of them don't. The Red Guard, or I shouldn't say the Red Guard, the Young Guard, whatever that means, like, certain, like, crazy far-left sects support the Popular Front, and certain do not. Mm. And it's interesting to see which ones do and which ones do not. If we can skip to the far left, the Lutte Ouvrière, the Worker Struggle Party, does not support the Popular Front. Uh-huh. Their position is that we will march with you in the streets, but we will not call people to your ballots. And this is a party that has been basically been accused of being a cult. I think calling it a cult is maybe too far, but when everybody in the party like needs a pseudonym and you're not allowed to have children and be a cadre, it kind of leads to cult accusations. Does that make sense?
Sure, sure. It's a bit cringe. I'm looking at the World Socialist website, by the way, other Trotskyists, other Fourth Internationalists, and their headlines. New Popular Front embraces war in French snap election campaign, and their big thing is like an anti-imperialism thing.
Well, the thing about the New Popular Front vis-a-vis the war, since we're jumping all over the place, let's just do it.
Yeah,
when it comes to Israel-Palestine, the New Popular Front proposes call for ceasefire, recognition of the state of Palestine, arms embargo to Israel.
That has some juice. Yeah, that would have real effects for sure.
That's fine. I don't know. I don't oppose that. That's fine. Vis-a-vis Ukraine, canceling Ukraine debt, funneling arms to Ukraine, no actual soldiers or military intervention in Ukraine.
Well, that's more than Macron is offering, right?
He's
offering.
I support canceling the debt of the Ukrainians. I'm a big fan of canceling debt in general.
Yeah.
It's not hard to get behind, right? So is that calling for war? I'm not a fan of Leon Trotsky, so people can make up their own minds about that.
Let's go back. Let's trust the plan.
Trust the plan. Let's continue. It's 11:30 French time. I'm trying to maintain coherence. So we were at the La Republica. Now we come to formerly La Republica. Actually, I've lost count of how many different names Macron parties had. It's either La Republica en Marche or Renaissance or something like this, right? But basically the Macron party, the pure center. Macron has relied on the right and the center right to rule. So we can think of Macron either as the pure center or as the center right. Macron's party suffered a huge defeat in the European elections. And I suspect, I can't prove, but I suspect that they will not do well in this coming election. And the reason is that the Macron party officials in like all of their statements, my read of what they've said is they're pretty shook. They're not in full agreement with each other. They don't give me the impression of confidence. Now that could be like 3D chess of like, oh, we'll project weakness and then we'll overperform expectations. Sure, that's possible. But
well, it's interesting to say that because I think how he came to power, which was in itself kind of a stunning reshuffling of the electoral cards in France, was that I think it was François Hollande of the Socialist Party was expected to win the 2016 election, and Macron's platform was that I'm going to be a strong executive and push forward reforms, regardless of what they are. I'll at least be someone who's capable of pushing things forward because the Socialist Party is so weak. And this was how the whole Jupiterian thing came to be, right? That he's going to be maybe Bonaparte type figure. He's been in power for 8 years now or something like that. So is the sense that there's just like no juice left in like the Macron mythos?
I think he, like, if you're asking me, and people can read my article if they want all the details, I personally think that Macron wants to govern with the far right.
Oh, interesting.
For two reasons. The first reason is that he can use the far right as a cudgel to beat the left and to beat the sort of popular discontent with his regime. Because remember, like, at certain moments in the Yellow Vest protest, like, big sequence, and I did 35 acts with the Yellow Vest. I was out there for, like, a long fucking time in the streets. There were moments where I think he had some, like, 25% approval rating. Mm. But it was like, very low approval, right? Lower even than Biden. And I think he can beat the left with the Popular Front. So I think that is one possible interpretation of him. I cannot prove any of this. We're talking about a man's intentions. That's between him and God on a certain level.
The left with a front with the National Assembly?
No, I mean, like, if, for example, if the national rally comes to party, right?
Right.
If they, if like, let's say they get a plurality, not even a majority. Let's say they get a plurality. So he does a kind of pseudo cohabitation with the far right. He can use that to force through certain measures that would be antisocial in nature.
I see. Okay. So you see? Instead of being a lame duck in his last 2 years, he'd be able to do parts of his agenda with them that he wouldn't be able to do otherwise.
And then he can justify it by saying, well, I'm blocking them from their worst excesses, right?
Okay. Yeah, so
he could do, I mean, this is my personal read. I'm not a political economist. This is my read of the situation.
This is exactly right? What Biden is doing right now with immigration, for example. He's putting forward the exact same stuff Trump was putting forward about shutting down the border and limiting asylum seeking to a minimum and general repression of immigration in like previously unforeseen ways that are blatantly illegal. But his excuse for doing it is like, well, if I don't do it, then Trump will do it, and he'll do it worse because he's mean and I'm nice.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Biden can like give with one hand and take from the other. That's what the Democrats can do. So he can shut down the borders and do more enforcement. He won't go as far as build the wall, but
continued building the wall.
Okay, so he builds the wall, but he also allows, what was it, 500,000 spouses of people on green cards to get citizenship or something like that?
Yeah,
like, it's very much like a centrist way of being like an anti-immigration guy.
Well, I'll say right now, just so the listeners understand my political line or position, I 100% refuse to vote for Joe Biden. I will not vote for him whatsoever. I'm not some kind of electoral triangulationist in general. I support the Popular Front for very particular political reasons, which we can talk about later, right? But people like Joe Biden, I have no interest in supporting in any respect.
Well, what I'm saying is that he's similar to Macron, so I wouldn't blame you there.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
of course. He's a reactionary figure. And I would say also, just for people that are listening that might be interested to know more about the European context, if they go to formspodcast.com, my last episode with friend of the Antifada, Pavlos Rufos, concerns the European immigration situation in particular.
Well, cool. I want to check that.
Yeah. Why don't you?
So I can listen to it.
Yeah. Why don't you sum that one up? Sum up some of that, because immigration is obviously a major reason for Le Pen's support.
But Andy, you have to trust the plan. He's only at Macron party.
We're only at the center. We have to get all the way to the left parties.
We've covered the left.
One of my favorite terms, put a pin in it. Let's put a pin in it.
Put a pin in it.
Circle back around like they say in corporate speak.
Andy, you have to be a disciplined cadre, you know? You have to be very disciplined.
Just go to Wikipedia if you want to know every little left party.
I love how as an American you've become so French that you're like cadre.
Yeah, the cadre. You know, well, I learned French in order that I could, you know, invite the woman who's now my wife to go dancing with me. So I had to, you know, pick it up.
That's really endearing as a story.
So yeah, it's very cute.
Immigration, we're going to talk about it in a global context and a French context. But first, what's to the left of Macron?
So after Macron, we have the Socialist Party, the PS. The Socialist Party is the former SFIO, the Party of the Second International, which I know that Andy holds dear as a diehard Second Internationalist.
Yeah, that's fine.
The Second International, the Socialist International, whatever, the PS has a sort of problem. That is, the PS actually has a split brain. So on the right of the PS, we have Raphael Glucksmann, who listeners that are theory heads like me will remember. Glucksmann, wasn't that the friend of Foucault? Yes. His father was the friend of Foucault.
He's like a legacy postmodernist.
He's a nepo baby of Foucault's circle. And Raphael Glucksmann also is the head of the public square party, I guess you would call it, the Place Publique, which is kind of like the right wing of the Socialist Party. From him, then you go to people like François Hollande, who is the former president, etc., who represents the kind of center-left. From there, you go through the PS, has a lot of people. Like, I work with a guy who's a PS supporter, and he's really troubled by some of the further left parties' statements about Israel-Palestine, right? And he feels like there's anti-Semitism on the left, which we can talk about in a minute.
Yeah, I read the Times article. Yeah, go on.
And part of the problem is like, and look, I'll be very blunt with you all. When Bernie Sanders gets up and says stuff, he's not always like a great politician, right? He's not always a great politician, folks. He comes out and says stuff like, what's happening in Gaza is terrible. Israel has a right to defend itself. Crickets, right? Yeah. Because he doesn't exactly know how to position himself. And this happens also in the French left.
He's also just being honest. Like, that's what he really thinks.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like an incoherent political, like for example, yesterday I was at a march with a 300 people that I mentioned earlier. And the guy at the end was saying, like, we support all of the people in Gaza and in Israel who want to live in peace. And like, yeah, okay, everybody can get behind that. Like, random civilians shouldn't be targeted, you know? Okay, that's easy to get behind, right? There's a political way to express things that's not stupid. And people on the French left don't always have good politics. They don't always have good, like, actual rhetoric, you know? And so my coworker that's, like, a little bit skittish about the Popular Front, he's not a total moron, right? He's somebody that, you know, he's Jewish, and he feels like certain things are sketchy. And part of the work of the Popular Front is telling this guy, like, no, we're not actually anti-Semitic, which we'll get to in a minute. Yeah. So from the socialist left, which represents the center left, we come to the French Communist Party, the PCF, the Third International, the Stalinists who have rejected Stalinism, right? The party of Georges Marchais and Robert Huet and Fabien Roussel, et cetera, et cetera. And what's really funny about the PCF is the degree to which they're like very clearly trying to get back all of the people they lost to the National Front and the National Rally by sort of playing with that rhetoric.
Yeah, this happened in Italy as well, where all of the previous solid communist voting regions went towards the right in the last few years.
There's also,
like, the fundamental... Oh, go ahead, Sean.
No, there's Sarah Wagenknecht, who in Germany formed a new party out of Die Linke, which Wagenknecht was like an attempt to do the same.
And they're doing well in certain areas, too.
In East Germany, especially. Because, like, the problem with the Communist Party was not just 1991 and the fall of the Soviet Union, but also, like, their literal social base, like, liquidated itself from the banlieue, right? The white working class essentially moved on, and they were never able to, like, capture the same demographic.
And basically, post-68, like, the PCF was lost.
Yeah.
They were just lost. They were, like, wandering in the desert, trying to figure out where the hell they are, you know.
Do they still have a stranglehold over the unions?
No.
Oh.
And that's actually part of the weird thing about the PCF. Is like, the PCF, the weird thing about the PCF is that, like for example, today, a couple hours ago, I was at a huge march, like I said, with tens of thousands of people. There was a PCF flag in the middle of the march. And, like, the Jeune Communiste, the young communist, like the youth section of the PCF, still has a lot of members. The PCF actually still has maybe like half the members of the DSA. And remember, like, France is about the size of Texas. So it's like a proportionally relatively strong compared to like US left parties. You know what I mean? But like, they don't have, how do I say? Their position is a little bit ideologically incoherent, I would say, because they try to position themselves as kind of like, do you remember the way the CPUSA used to sell itself of like, communism is the new Americanism or whatever?
Yeah, that Browderism shit, yeah.
That's kind of like where the PCF is now. They're like trying to appeal to the far right voters by saying like, we're the real good French left that you like and that you left and you should come back.
It's an appeal to nationalism, but they also presumably want to go back to like what the 30 glorious years and like the welfare state that comes out of that, right?
Yeah, there's something to that. There's something like, how do I say? Like, when I was talking a minute ago about Zemmour and Zemmour's appreciation for Georges Marchais, you know? And Georges Marchais kind of marks, in my mind at least, the beginning of the sort of like celebrity politician on the left, which has been fulfilled by Jean-Luc Mélenchon and François Ruffin and Sandrine Rousseau and other left figures. But the thing about Georges Marchais is like, he could come up and make like a good jab at Chirac, you know, in like a TV interview. But then behind it, he would defend objectively, I mean, I don't know how else to put it, racist policies. Call me the king of wokeism if you want. I'll take it, you know. Bulldozing housing for migrants is racist. Mm. You've just banned me from all the PCF locals. But when you go to like a weird small town in France, like in the middle of nowhere, sometimes you will find in the middle of that town, a PCF local. Mm. They did have a huge amount of support back in the day. And the Third International is nothing to be scoffed at in this country. The PCF is objectively the party of resistance in a real way,
right?
You know, yeah. And it still has a kind of credibility from them. And if you think about the way the sort of the Nukes coalition collapsed, the leaders of the PCF were critiquing La France Insoumise, we're going to talk about in a minute, as, you know, unclear about anti-Semitism, right? And so, you know, the leaders of the PCF would go in marches against anti-Semitism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They would get invited on TV. They would attack Jean-Luc Mélenchon, blah, 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 blah. And a lot of people have a resentment against the PCF because they did not join the electoral coalition in 2022. And their sort of small march, they were like the Ralph Nader of Mélenchon, if you want to put it that way. Okay. And if anybody French listening and wants to cut me a new asshole, just remember, I'm trying to explain things for the American audience.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Well, how did Mélenchon become so popular, if take so much support from, I presume, also from the Communist Party and the Socialist Party?
Well, the thing about Mélenchon, so now we're going from the PCF, another step left, to the France Insoumise, the France Unbowed, or if you want a more sadomasochistic translation, the unsubmissive French.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is a more literal translation. The unsubby French. Right? And
who's their Dom? I guess their daddy Dom is Macron, right?
That would be the implication of what I've said, Sean. Mm-hmm. Yes, that would be the implication.
Gotcha.
The
terms I can understand.
We're just translating in terms that Americans can understand.
Exactly, yeah. Maybe America.
One of the funniest things.
We have tête dans coup when it comes to French politics. So we got to figure this shit out.
One of the funniest things about living in France is that French people will just like blare American music that has like extreme vulgarities. Like at every demo, they do Rage Against the Machine super loud, like, fuck you, I won't do what you tell me, you know? But like totally uncensored. You go into the supermarket, it's like Biggie Smalls with no bleeping, you know?
It's unbowed, dude. They don't bow.
It's unbowed. It's unbowed.
Unbowed.
Yeah, didn't Hollande use N-words in Paris in one of his campaign videos?
I love globalization, dude.
Shit, man. I have no idea if that's true, but I believe it.
It's great for comedy.
I can believe that. Oh, man. How do we even pull back from that? So let's talk about Mélenchon. So the thing about Mélenchon is, I would say Mélenchon is the closest analog to Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn, if both of those men were actually further left. Mm. So basically everything in like American politics,
he's like a callback to a former era, like a different politics and like reviving it, or just in terms of his policy.
Well, just in terms of his policy.
Okay.
In terms of a former era, like I study French history. I have been involved in a number of movements, which we can talk about later, Andy, if you want. But I don't pretend to be some kind of expert.
But we'll have to talk about Mitterrand at some point, right?
Because we have to talk about Mitterrand at a certain point, right?
I'm just came together, but go on.
Yeah, but let's just say that I was married on Rue Lénine, okay? Mm. So I'm very familiar with the sort of French communist history. And like I'm making fun of it a little bit in this interview, but there is something to be said about, like yesterday, for example, I was marching in a smaller town. There were 300 people. At the end of the march, I asked some of the locals. I was like, this is a town where I don't live. I went to support as a member of the union and also for journalistic reasons for this interview. I asked some locals, like, how does this compare to normal marches? I said, this is so much bigger than what we're used to. Because we're deep, like, here in the Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur, in the southeast corner of France, this is pretty deep, like far right territory, you know, like Eric Ciotti is from Nice, you know, which is our biggest town. Right?
Yeah, Marseille was like a little hotbed of communist activity surrounded by like a big swath of Vichy politics, right?
Well, I mean, it wasn't always like this. Like where I live used to be a further left position, you know, but they lost a lot of support. Anyway, when I was talking to these people, they said, you know, this is actually a really good turnout for us. And I, you know, and in that march, something I'll never forget is near the tête de cortège, the front of the march, there was a man, I didn't talk to him. There's a man holding a red banner, a pure red banner. And on that banner in black ink was written simply 1871.
We found our guy.
And under that banner, there was marching a guy with like a kid in his shoulders and some old women. Right. Mm. And that to me is an evocative.
Was one of them playing an accordion?
No accordion was playing. They were playing Rage Against the Machine. Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me.
He's very loudly. An organ grinder version of Rage Against the Machine, but with like a little monkey on his shoulder and shit.
No, it was the CGT. I mean, honestly, one of the benefits of being the CGT is that at every protest, they have a van that can do all the loudspeaker shit. And if you go to Paris, they'll often have a van with like beers and stuff off the back of it, which is very nice.
Hell yeah. Drink some Cronenbergs. That might fucking
have a little 1664 while you're walking around.
That's right. They need to make a Cronenberg 1871. That's all I'm saying.
1871 would be insane. Yo, it would taste like sweat.
Tastes like gunpowder. We're like almost at an hour. What do you think, Andy? Should we like go behind the paywall?
We have to continue.
All right, we have to continue. Our France correspondent says
we haven't even begun to talk about the situation, Andy.
I know. I was trying to get through this spectrum so we could get there, but do you think
so? We're getting through the spectrum. So let's continue to left. So La France Insoumise, founded by Mélenchon, right? Mélenchon has this sort of particular celebrity, and this is a problem, I would say, in the French left. This reliance on celebrity, to me, is a real limit. It's not good. To go back to sort of the critique of the lettrist, etc., I think the spectacle of the celebrity is bad, just objectively speaking. But La France Insoumise, as a party, does an interesting thing, which is similar to the DSA. It pulls people from other parties. So you could be a member of the Socialist Party and in the France Insoumise in a way, right? And you pull people in the France Insoumise. The France Insoumise mobilizes a lot of people that were not involved in electoral politics. Specifically, you know, I'll just be blunt about it. People that are not white. I see a lot of people that are not white in the France Insoumise. And they have a certain approach to politics, which is extremely combative relative to other French parties. Like they'll unfurl a Palestinian flag in the National Assembly. And that becomes a major controversy. And La France Insoumise is comfortable with being a party of controversy, being a party of confrontation, right? Then after that, you have the new anti-capitalist party, which is also part of the Popular Front, which is basically, as one of my coworkers put it, the anti-cap, like the anarchist party is the NPA. And then you have the sort of like Trotskyist sectarians, like the Lutte Ouvrière, the Workers' Struggle, who refuse to be part of the party, et cetera, et cetera. And sort of in between, in the mix, you have the Green Party, you have the Ruralist Party, you have, Sean, you'll like this, the Animalist Party.
The Animalists? I like that. Sounds cool. I'm an animal, so that party's for me.
You ready to support the Animalists?
I'm going to form the Mammals Party. We represent all mammals against reptiles and avians.
Are they vegan or are they just like into animal rights and that sort of thing?
Animal rights.
Oh, cool. That's a nice single issue to have a party around.
I think it's insane to have an Animalist Party personally, but you know,
no, I love
that shows my colors.
I love it though. I think it's
as a vulgar workerist, I don't really believe in supporting the Animalist Party, but it exists.
But you think the Animalists are the farthest left party?
I wouldn't say that personally. We also have like the Ruralist parties, and one of these guys is very funny. You can look it up on YouTube. He's always like tending his goats with no shirt on, just like pushing like a hand scythe or whatever on his farm in the Pyrenees.
Oh, is this the guy who would he would like walk around the Pyrenees as his election campaign? He was like
exactly
the mountaineering party.
Or what was
exactly
animals? Was he pro animals or anti?
I think it would be considered anti animal because he likes to eat them.
See, that's not a politics I can get behind.
You know, the Nazis also had like this animalist wing too, where they were like, kosher slaughter is overly cruel. And they were able to like win over some like animal lovers that way.
Jesus Christ, just using anti-Semitism?
Yeah. Wow,
fuck.
Well, I mean, the vegans, we can put the vegans to their own side here. But basically, we've done a little tour of the main parties, right? So basically, everybody from the Socialist Party, so the Second International, the Third International, and some of the Fourth International parties all support the Popular Front. People like Raphael Glucksmann ended up kind of getting drug into the Popular Front because it would have been shameful not to. But they did not form the Popular Front. The Popular Front, the new Popular Front, I should say, is not a cross-class coalition in the way that the old Popular Front was.
Okay.
It's a front formed from the labor and sort of militant center of the workers' movement, the center of the left, so to speak, and then the sort of soft left parties jumped onto it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think that makes sense.
And so I would say that the new Popular Front and the old Popular Front disagree or are different in three or a few key ways, right? The first is that it's not a waste of time because we only have a few weeks. And really, we only have a week left before the elections start. And if the national rally comes to party power, like if this Le Pen, Bardella party comes to power, all of this sequence will provide the sort of momentum or the ignition or the kickstart of the resistance that's needed. Does that make sense?
If they come to power, this will be like an opening salvo of how to resist the national rally's policy.
Because it's basically saying, like, we don't care about all of our divisions, right? Like, Andy, you're in the Green Party. You're somebody that bikes to work.
I'm in right? the mammals party.
You're in the animalist party, right?
No, not all animals. I don't care about lizards and I don't care about birds, just mammals. I stand with capybaras, humans, apes, dogs, cows, goats. You know, do I have to name all? Okay, I'll keep naming them.
Keep naming all the mammals.
Beavers,
right?
Otters.
Yeah.
But yes, okay.
I don't know if all of those participate, right? But the idea is that basically, like, look, I'm a father, I'm a worker, I'm a husband. I spend a lot of time on playgrounds these days. And moms on the playground ask me, when is the next protest?
So there is like a deep revulsion that like is across large swaths of society right now towards this policy.
And right now is the moment where people can put aside their sort of sectarian differences on the electoral level and say, right now we have to actually form a front that is going to oppose this nonsense, right? And I think that's meaningful. I don't think that's bullshit.
But here's so we've gone through the spectrum. We trusted the plan and you got us there in only about an hour, which is pretty good. I'm not even being facetious. That's pretty good. Despite Andy and I's best attempt at trying to interrupt you and take things forward. So I guess like what you're arguing for the Popular Front is you're saying this is only a month long process. We're almost at the end of it. What is the harm in whatever like particular party or sect that we're in with simply pulling the lever and saying no to Le Pen? Fair enough.
And not only no, but yes to a positive, like yes a positive. I defy anybody onto the left to say to me that you would not prefer that workers can retire at 60 versus 65, right? Like if you pretend to be part of the workers' movement in any sense and you're not for less time on the job, I don't know what the hell you're on about.
Well, where I would go immediately is I would point to like Mitterrand, right? And I would be like, Mitterrand had great policies around lowering the retirement age, of nationalizing various industries, raising taxes on the rich. Immediately upon that Popular Front of socialists and communists getting into office, you had a massive capital flight and you had basically like capital strangling the French economy, forcing him not only to backtrack, but actually become a similar to like a Jimmy Carter type figure in the United States and being a harbinger of what we now call neoliberalism. That's not to say that like in that instance, nobody should have voted for the Communist Party and try to get Mitterrand in power. It's only to say that it seems to me that this new Popular Front will immediately start running into the headwinds of production and reproduction and the global world.
Macron has a plan for this.
Macron's got a plan?
Yeah. He is joining Lula in this movement to tax billionaires internationally.
Oh, yeah. Impressive international thing.
Okay. And my sense, knowing very little about it, is that it's just a way for him to not have to tax Bernard Arnault and, you know, the other French billionaires domestically. You know, if you support this like scheme that will probably never happen because the United States and other countries will never support it, you could just say, well, I believe in taxing the 1%, but you know, it has to be done internationally or not at all.
And it's a nice, like, progressive, like, internationalist way of dealing with the various, like, inequalities and contradictions among nation states and, like, a global capitalist economy. But the real headline thing, right, is not whether billionaires move their funds whether like Gerard Depardieu moves to like Belgium, right? Which is the last time
there. I don't think he's a billionaire, but yeah.
Well, but he's a rich man and he moves away for the, but the point is what does capital do, right? So like capital is more than just rich people and their taxes. It's about investment, it's about production, it's about profits. And so like France makes itself not quite a nice environment for capital investment, and we see what happens from there. I'm sounding very cynical right now because...
No, it's okay. I appreciate this. Let me just pose to you a question, right?
Yeah.
Are we in 1934 or not?
You're asking me that, or you're asking it rhetorically?
Like, just think about it rhetorically, right?
Bloom. Should I vote for... What was the guy's name? What was his first name? Something Bloom.
But think about Bordiga's critique. I mean, we're on the Intifada. We're not on, like, Daniel Denver's the dick. Okay, so I think we can go a little bit deeper than a lot of people do, right?
Hell yeah, do it.
If you think about Bordiga's critique, his critique is very, in my mind, and look, I'm not a professor, I'm not an academic, I'm just a stupid engineer, right? What do I know about theory? All I do is make things happen in reality, right?
Yeah.
But in terms of just reality, what is Bordiga's critique? The Popular Front represents a sort of electoral waste of time. Occupying the factories is a waste of time. We need to seize state power. Now, I'm speaking as a communist. I am not a nihilist. I'm not an anarchist. I'm a communist. Okay. Mm-hmm. So speaking as a communist, his critique, I think in his time and place, made sense. And I'm willing to defend his thesis. I'm willing to defend his proposal to the Communist Party in Italy about the rise of fascism. I think he was correct. Right. I'm saying today in our time, what is concretely the situation now? What is the situation in our material historical circumstance? In our material historical circumstance, the Popular Front does not represent a waste of time because, again, we're talking about a few weeks of action. And if the far right comes to power, then we're going to have to go into a resistance mode. I don't see any way of avoiding that. I don't see any world in which these neo-fascists come to power and we don't make some kind of mobilization. Mm.
So maybe what we could do now is talk a little bit about what that resistance would look like and has looked at like outside of parliament. Does that make sense?
I'm fine.
Yeah, of course, but like
no, I'd like to make like what hopefully is a substantive point, which is that I've been a great critic of the Popular Front over the last couple of years, and Andy as well. We've had a lot of guests on who are, you know, who understand the Popular Front as like the historical submission and liquidation of the workers' movement, like into social democracy, into liberalism, into progressivism, or whatever. But like France is a different situation, right? Because why do we want to break the Popular Front in the United States? It's to have some sort of like independent political and economic power of the class that like stands for itself autonomously and independently from the bourgeois parties. It seems to me that France, like, that isn't so much your issue, right? Maybe it's your issue is more like breaking with nationalism or break, because you have strong like communist trade unions. You have like enough of a communist working class left that you can throw up like 25, 28, 30% vote in an election. So I wouldn't like discount the new Popular Front offhand, like out of hand. I think we have to look at, as you said, and like directly at the historically contingent issues, not just in this day and age, not Bordiga's time 100 years ago, but also understand that France has a particular historical trajectory and a particular politics that doesn't exactly like parallel the United States, for example, or Britain or China or anywhere else.
I mean, Andy, make sure this goes into the free part of the episode, because I want to be very explicit with the listener. I have been and remain associated with the quote unquote Appelist current for many years. Okay.
AKA the Tacoonists.
And I do not speak on behalf of anybody but myself. Okay. But speaking for myself, what we're seeing right now is an opportunity. The suspension of all the sectarian bullshit is an opportunity for people to meet, to struggle, and to live together in a way that has not been present since the Gilets Jaunes, since the Yellow Vest movement. And I was somebody that invested very heavily in the Yellow Vest movement, and I don't regret any of it. It was a beautiful and brilliant moment. It was very important
to see from overseas, too.
Yeah, and very exciting, right? And what I see right now, again, is a mobilization of people against a common enemy and for a common program. And that program represents not only sort of rhetorical, whatever, blah, 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 but real material gains. That look at what the CGT head of the Marseille department had to say, right? I'll translate in English. What he said very clearly, as I recall, is that the new Popular Front is not an electoral coalition, but it's a tool of the working class to gain real gains, to gain its own revindications, to gain its own demands, right? I think that is true. And call me an opportunist if you want. I'll accept that. I'll accept being the right wing of the sort of apolice current, if that's what I have to be, right? But I think this is a very serious issue.
One of the things that a part of the broader context of this that I just thought about is Germany, right? The two pillars, of course, of like the European Union going all the way back to the economic community, right? In the second half of the 20th century, two pillars have been Germany and France. And we know that Germany really took the front seat for much of that time, especially when it comes to fiscal policy. Germany seems to have like given up or like abrogated its responsibility really over like pushing the European Union forward and even leading it in many senses, like leading from behind now with like the United States really in control. So it'll be interesting to see with this election, the way that France has like this remaining national power within that might be the bellwether for where we go post neoliberalism, right? Like
look at Spain, right? Like it's not pre-written. Like this is something that comes across in every CGT communique. The future history is not written in advance.
Yeah.
There's nothing that requires us to accept the rise of the far right. And this is maybe where I'm showing my post-Marxist colors here. But there's no capital H history that decides that the far right has to come to power. Right. I fully reject that notion.
Might this be, and I'm not saying this offhandedly, might this be a pre-revolutionary situation? Like
what do you call a new constitution if not revolutionary?
That's true, yeah.
I mean, is that not what the definition of a revolution is? We change the constitution of a country?
Yeah,
that's so a I don't strongly disagree with what you're saying. What I'm interested in like the narrative that you've put out so far, and like maybe going back to Bordiga, you know, this critique of the Popular Front, Bordiga maintains this, but we're not talking about 1934. We're talking about 1919, 1920, 1921, and it's really a debate within the Communist Party about this, you know, the strategies of what comes next. You know, there was a near revolutionary situation after World War One in Italy, factories occupied all over the North, fascism forming in response to that. And how do we fight back? Do we launch a general insurrection? This was more Bordiga's line. Or do we pivot to a more anti-fascist stance? I think is more Gramsci's line. That's not exactly how it played out. You're right. The situation is very different today, where it's not like the choice is insurrection or Popular Front anti-fascism. You're trying to say that pretty much the only thing that's on the table, both for bread and butter working class issues and for launching any meaningful resistance against the far right, is through the Popular Front in victory or out of in failing and launching a unified movement that has potential to fight Le Pen.
Let me put it to you very simply. I remember in the Yellow Vests, the unions were aloof. The left in general was aloof. A lot of people tried to paint the Yellow Vests as reactionary, et cetera, et cetera. The Yellow Vest was an autonomous movement. It was a movement of people that weren't necessarily even workers, just literal potatoes in a sack, who stood up and said, we don't want to be in the sack, you know? And that doesn't fit with a clean Marxist interpretation of capital H history and how it's supposed to work. But again, I'm an engineer. I'm not a scientist.
Well, the potatoes in the sack, right? Comes from Marx, so it's not exactly outside of...
No, but you see what I'm saying? I'm saying, like, as an empirical matter, I saw the potatoes in the sack get up and try to seize power. Right? I saw the potatoes in the sack get up and lose eyes and lose members and bleed out on the streets of Paris. I saw that with my own eyes.
This goes back to what I was saying before about the Popular Front, the difference between, say, the United States and France, is that because of we have a revolutionary history here, of course, but because of France's unique revolutionary tradition, the sort of like what we might call like civil social organizing, like does happen on a scale in France that like still to this day that maybe we haven't seen in the United States for like, I don't know, 40, 50 years or so. So there's like,
look, yeah, American comrades, learn French. It's not that hard. Like, learn French, follow what's happening, translate texts, you know?
I got
like, France and America have a lot in the common. In fact, I would say that France and America have more in common than France, than America, than Mexico, right? Even if they're on the same continent, the sort of disposition of forces and the way that the society works, it's much more similar than you think, you know?
We both had revolutions around the same time.
So my theory, Andy, is very simple. The Popular Front represents a teleological suspension of sectarianism. It represents a kind of political party suspension of saying, you know, vis-a-vis what happened in 2022 and other elections, actually, in some places, only the PCF will run. In other places, only the France Insoumise will run. In other places, only the Socialist Party will run. And the Popular Front calls on electors in all of those places to vote for one unique candidate. This was not the case with the NUPES.
Okay, so the sectarianism suspended for the elections.
Yes.
And you've talked about the Gilets Jaunes and Nid Debout and you know all of these riotous moments. And maybe you could throw the Banlieue riots into that as well. And
the thing is that this suspension, this teleological suspension of the sectarian is an opportunity for people who want a more autonomous left movement to intervene. Because right now, whether you're PCF or Socialist Party or whatever, doesn't matter. You're all in the Popular Front. You're all hitting the streets at the same time. Now is a moment post-COVID to meet everybody, to make new connections, to organize with people. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And if you don't take that opportunity, I don't know what the hell you're doing.
I'm wondering that if you're suspending sectarianism, that there's also a suspension of tactics to some extent, because there has to be a unity in tactics. And in this case,
the tactics are really simple. Like, do you show up for a march or not? Well, are you willing to vote for the one unique candidate in every district or not?
That's not really so simple, because when you show up to the march, you have to behave in a certain way if you have a tactical unity in terms of what that march is about. So my question is basically, how can the more street politics tactics exist within this coalition moving forward?
I'll simply tell you what I do, right? I go to the march. I march with everybody. I put my kid in my stroller, okay? And I push the kid through the streets with everybody else. And I talk to people. I listen to what they say. I talk to them. I take their phone numbers, right? And I try to build something that's parallel to whatever is happening. I don't say, hey, you should not be in the PCF. You should not be in the Socialist Party. You should not be in the CGT, whatever, right? I let people be in whatever organization they want to be in already, right? But I try to meet people where they're at. Since they are so dedicated, they're willing to show up, say, hey, let's exchange contacts. And like, maybe Americans don't understand this because you never had a real lockdown, but shit was completely shut down. Mm. The whole issue of immigration was taken off the table by the lockdowns. Mm. The issue of like the yellow vests and uprisings, you can't have a mass uprising when you're only allowed to leave your house for a couple hours per day. Let's be honest about that.
Well,
this is the moment where people can come into the street, meet each other, make connections and say, hey, whatever like other organization or like left, blah, blah, blah stuff we're a part of, we're also part of this other thing that's parallel to that. Not contradictory, but parallel to that, right? And the idea of making a sort of parallel organization, I think, is not bullshit. The fact that like now I have a list of people that I can call up and say, hey, we're going to do this on this day, I don't think that's bullshit. And if anything, actually it's less bullshit than the groupuscule, as we say in French, the little groups of like militants. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's calling it bullshit.
I think you're missing my point. Like, for a better example, like let's say that Le Pen wins and starts aggressively moving against immigrant communities. Obviously, anti-Muslim rhetoric is a major aspect of her platform. In the United States, when Trump came in, there was this mobilization against ICE, for example, these sort of mutual aid efforts to like look out for ICE, to like blockade ICE buildings, that sort of thing. Is that something that would fit into, would that be something that would be encouraged? Or another example, you know, you had these major Banlieue riots, I think just about a year ago in France, that no one across the political spectrum, to my knowledge, in France really knew what to make of it, except for the right, you know, who could like use it as a fuel for law and order rhetoric. Is that something that the Popular Front would support, or would it, would that be too much for them?
Right. Well, one more example, because I think it's an important one. Like when oil refinery workers like on strike blockade the highways, you know, or there's like factory takeovers and things of that sort. Is that also, as Andy asked, like within the remit, within the realm of the Popular
Front? Well, it depends on how you view the Popular Front. If you view the Popular Front in a sort of media dominated lens, where you see it as an electoral coalition, then no, it's not within the remit. Okay. If you view it as the CGT head of Marseille sees it, as a tool for the workers to gain their demands, then it is. And when I view like activist groups like the Soulèvement de la Terre, the Earth Uprising movement, who say we need to have a strong anti-fascist positioning, like I'll just level with you guys. I have been involved in anti-fascist stuff in the US. I don't think that like the small squads of Antifa and FA fighting in the streets has always been particularly useful or helpful. Mm. Okay. I think there's room for critique there. Mm. There's a huge difference between that and literal neo-fascists are trying to take control of the parliament. Mm. Right. And everybody that is awake, even the fucking center right, people like Villepin, understand that it's a real threat. That's a different kind of mobilization. Whatever you want to like ethically judge it, I think from a sort of materialist empirical analysis of the situation, it's very different. And when I look at the situation, I see a huge opportunity for people to construct a parallel pole of mobilization of saying, right now, the Popular Front, we're trying to get people elected. Yeah, elections aren't that great. I understand that. I'm very aware of that. Let's say the far right wins. Who is going to be in a position to oppose the far right? It's the people that already have their list of contacts from right now. Mm. You see what I mean? It's the people that are already out there right now. And when you say the far right came to power, you can say, yeah, I was opposing that the whole fucking time, right? It's a very simple, it's like a very clear way of signaling to people. And, so, and for me as an engineer, it's just very simple. Like we need to right now construct our parallel movement where we don't necessarily contradict the electeds. We allow the electeds to do their thing. But whatever the electeds do, we are prepared for the future.
So you can see the electoral process, the political reconstitution of like a broad Popular Front as an instrument of the class, as not like subordinating these other things, but instead as another tool in the toolbox to try to push mobilizations forward, to try to push self-organization forward, and to try in the meantime to like quell this threat, which will change entirely, presumably, the makeup of France in a fascist direction. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, think about it very clearly. What in like a fully Leninist analysis, what is the point of election?
To stand up and say no, and it's to use it as a bully pulpit, right? And to use
and also
it
to test your strength. It's to build that muscle. It's right. To test how much weight can I literally push, you know? Like I'm out there walking with people, they're like, man, you're walking fast. You're not tired yet, you know? Because I'm used to walking around and marching around. You see what I mean?
I think we're sort of going in circles here for a second, much like a march.
Go ahead.
Maybe we can sort of wrap up on this question. Because we haven't really talked about the French political economy yet. And I don't really know much about it, although I'm aware that luxury products are now a major part of France's economy. But it, sure. You know, looking to the UK, who's also having these sort of snap elections, the UK economy just seems completely fucked. Like their manufacturing base has fallen out. Their sort of only hope of maintaining their standard of living is to build up their finance capacity in London as like a center of finance rivaling New York. And I think as a result of that, the elections there are looking far more dismal than they are in France, because it's against a increasingly center-right Labour Party, a slightly farther center-right Tory Party, and then the...
Andy, why are you asking about Perfide Albion? You know I've never set foot on the Blasted Isle.
Well, my question.
I have nothing but contempt for the British.
Well, let me finish my question. Maybe you'll understand. And then you've got Farage surging in the polls. Labour, you know, looking at the polls, Labour is dipping. Farage's Reform UK party, which is pretty similar to Maloney and Le Pen, is now passing the Tories. I can't help but think that maybe in France, these questions of immigration, these questions of anti-fascism and a place for the left to assert a platform within it has to do with France still maintaining some sort of manufacturing capacity that the UK's lost, especially when it comes to the question of immigration, because of course, when we're talking about immigration and in terms of how national economies deal with or discipline or accept immigrants, it has to do with them as a exploitable workforce.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm not Pavlos Rufos. I invite Pavlos Rufos on my show because he's the political economist, not me, right? I will say, as somebody that works in France, this idea of Macron of like the startup nation is total horseshit. France is not a startup nation. And, you know, as a member of the CGT, Sophie Binet, our leader, has very clearly talked about the deindustrialization of certain sectors, for example, steel production, and called for the French government to nationalize certain steel production if, in fact, it fails to be profitable in the private sector, right? If you're asking about, like, the hard numbers of, like, the economy and the political economy, I'm just not the right person to ask.
No, I guess my question is just sort of like, is there more hope in France for it to retain its manufacturing base, whereas that hope seems to have vanished from the UK?
There's a story about the EU that sees the EU as kind of reconstituting Charlemagne's medieval empire between France and Germany, right? And this idea of a sort of Franco-German union is the sort of heart of the EU. I don't know if I fully believe that. What I can say is that I know that Macron and others have tried to position France as a sort of alternative for capital once Britain did their Brexit. I don't know to the degree to which that has, you know, been achieved. France still maintains a somewhat colonial enterprise vis-a-vis West Africa, for example, or what's happening in New Caledonia, where there's a major uprising of the Kanaks.
The major source of rare metals for France, right? Like what they need for electric vehicles and that sort of thing.
I mean, if you look at like the West African sort of far left leaders from Thomas Sankara on down, they always said like Africa is rich and Europe is poor. And they're talking about the raw materials, et cetera, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Now it's interesting to think about what's happening in France in the global perspective. I'm glad that Andy's tried to put the comparative example in there of the UK. And I think that what's happening in West Africa right now, which, you know, is good and bad, depending on how you look at it, leads France to be at a real like junction, right? Like a real inflection point right now. And I wonder what the Popular Front's take on like France Afrique, like what's happening in West Africa right now. How does the left interface?
That's a good question, because this is why the Popular Front collapsed in 1959, right? An inability to have a coherent position on Algeria.
What do you think, Henry? What's their take on various military juntas and other sort of like national liberation movements trying to get out from under the orbit of France, which if people don't know.
Well, in a way, one of the weird things about living in France is that the sort of France Afrique and what we call the Outre-mer, the other side of the sea, so to speak, tends to be kind of forgotten in a way, unless people go on vacation to the island of Reunion, you know. If I may sort of dodge the question and zoom out, I would say I think there's two major problems. Let's assume the Popular Front comes to power. Andy expressed doubt about this earlier, but there is a situation in which the Popular Front does actually win. Like, it is within the realm of possibility that the new Popular Front can win, which was not the case really with Bernie, if we're being honest. Like, as we say in French, malgré everything that Jacobin said, it's not like, I think actually the chance of us winning in France is higher than Bernie winning, just for the record. Let's say the Popular Front wins, the new Popular Front wins. The immediate divisions of the new Popular Front are going to be on this topic that you all just raised, nuclear power, and probably how to deal with immigration in general. Does that make sense? Those are kind of the three issues that I think would be very divisive. And the new Popular Front, as far as I know, and look, if somebody in the comments, again, feel free to tear me a new one for my ignorance, As far as I've seen, there hasn't been a lot of talk about New Caledonia, for example, or Nigeria or Niger or the West African situation in general. I think, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I suspect that I'm not French and I don't know like a super lot about this, but I suspect it's because it's a post-colonial relationship, right? Like these West African countries especially have used the franc, the French franc. And continue to use a franc that is, and the capital investments and obviously movements of people back and forth have been very strong for a while, but it hasn't been a direct subjugation like you saw in Algeria or elsewhere, right? So it seems to me like
Palestine is a much more important issue. People talk a lot about Palestine.
In France, similar to the United States, there's like a deep state, right? There's like the legacy, like military industrial blob and like the financiers who like, you know, have various roots in government to ensure that a post-colonial arrangement quietly, you know, allows them to gather up resources in like places they had formerly colonized. And they're similar to what I think you saw with Corbyn, the rejection of Corbyn in the UK by the quote unquote establishment or whatever, was largely over foreign policy shit, right? It was
Think about nuclear power, right? Like we don't have uranium in this country, as far as I know.
Right.
So we need to get the uranium from nowhere, from somewhere, right? And like we produce a lot of nuclear power. We export nuclear power to Germany, for example, and Italy and other neighboring countries, right? So the PCF, the French Communist Party, is a strong supporter of nuclear power. Other aspects of the left are not strong supporters of it. This is a part where the New Popular Front does not agree. If the New Popular Front came to power, there'd be a major rancor and disagreement about how to deal with nuclear power.
Right.
Why do we need a presence in Niger or in these other countries? Well, we need uranium to power the nuclear reactors. You see what I mean?
This is the sort of thing where we can all speculate about how this coalition might govern. We can also speculate, and as your France correspondent, I'm sure you'll come back and report on what happens if Le Pen's party wins and how they govern, what the reaction would be to that. We can all speculate about these things, but I think in this hour and 40 minutes or so, you've given us a really good summation of like what the political terrain looks like and a lot of what the stakes are.
I hope so.
Who think revolutionarily about this, who stand for the working class, its self-organization, and ultimately its quest for power. I think that this was a great conversation. If we don't like solve everything by the end, it's because, God, there's an election in 1 week and we're all going to see what happens.
But yeah, we can see what happens afterward. The thing is, like, I have a fundamentally pro-revolutionary orientation, right? But the reality is that, like I've said before, I'm a father. I'm a worker. I'm not a professional militant. I'm not paid to do activism. Mm. And when people on the playground are asking me, when is the next protest? I think that matters. Absolutely. Because folks on the playground, you know, a lot of those folks are refugees from Ukraine. I know a lot of Ukrainian refugees. That's a lot of people that I personally know because of my own personal situation, right? That's a significant amount of people. And folks need to remember that we're like the Syrian refugees. I know a lot of Syrian refugees. Mm. I know a lot of people that have fled from Africa. I know a lot of people that have fled from all kinds of situations that are in this country, right? And they are all united about the idea that the far right coming to power is seriously a threat to us. And when you think about it, like, does the Antifada support menstrual leave or not?
I support that.
Sure. It's the first I've heard of it, but I support it.
Yeah, it's the first I heard of it, but sounds good to me.
No, but that's like a part of the Popular Front. It's like, we support menstrual leave. Like, imagine the U.S.
Recently, if menstrual Jewish leave was on the table. Menstrual leave.
You know what I mean? Like, that's not on the table in the U.S. Like, Biden getting elected won't get women menstrual leave.
They don't even have maternity leave in this country. There's like a larger there's a larger question here where we can be like super abstract about things. Bringing Bordiga into the conversation about the Popular Front is already abstracting a lot away from what's happening on the ground.
No, but I think his critique is very concrete. It's a waste of time, you know? It's a waste of time, is his critique.
In a broader scheme, these abstract questions, I think, are very important. But what I appreciate about your view and your analysis and what you've brought to this episode and will bring to further episodes as our France correspondent is that you can speak as _A_worker and somebody that's trying to like work through the this actual historically contingent moment where things could go really badly, or things could just be like the normal amount of bad. And none of us here in the United States or wherever the listeners are listening to this are facing the same decision that like a French working class person is facing right now in the face of what might be an utter catastrophe. So I think we need to be concrete in this situation. You've given us a lot to concretize it. And then when the dust settles or in the course of this, then we can abstract away from it. We can learn lessons. We've already made some comparisons between, say, the UK and France, the US and France, what a popular front looks like in the US with the Democrats versus what it looks like over in France. And there's deep historical questions and abstractions we could talk about to the end of time. But an hour and 45 minutes in, I just want to say, Henry, thank you for this. This has been a tour de force, as they say in France.
Well, I appreciate the support. If I can say one final thing that maybe makes this kind of puts a bow on this for the American listener.
Put a bow on.
Imagine that the DSA came to be some kind of hegemonic force from the left. Mm. What would that mean? What would it mean if like Jacobin Magazine was the leading organ of the left in terms of the press, right? What would it mean if you have to choose between, what'd you say?
It kind of is, but that's because our left is very small.
No, I still read the old commune articles, goddamn it.
Oh, right. Yeah, rest in peace.
I can tell.
Rest in peace to commune.
I can tell which one you've read, too.
Yeah, I'm reading all of those old articles by a certain AP Andy about anti-fascism.
Yeah, that's a great article. Andy really came out of the gate strong with that one.
But think about, like, I'm gonna leave the listeners with a critique, right? If you want to really get messed up, if you really want to break your mind on French politics, look up what happened with the France Insoumise after the formation of the New Popular Front. With a particular red-haired candidate from the north of France called, I actually don't know how to pronounce his name correctly, Catenens, I guess. Catenens.
Red-haired, huh? Is this like that MIA video that came out about
Jews? Even worse, he was convicted in a court of justice of beating his wife.
Oy, oy, oy.
And the LFE, the France Insoumise, decided to run him anyway and also eject certain members that had been previously running in certain districts for like insufficient loyalty to Mélenchon, right? Mm. And this caused a huge scandal where like people like François Ruffin said, like, you know, fuck you. Like, how do you dare talk about me when you're running a guy who's been convicted of beating his wife, right? And like, imagine the level of just like infighting that could happen. And not only infighting, but like ethical collapse. You see what I mean? I don't know how, actually let me ask you guys, because you've been asking me questions. What do you all think about like Fidel Castro and this idea of the left as kind of like chivalrous? Do you see yourselves as Don Quixote or not?
I think we need to tilt at some motherfucking windmills, that's for sure. We need to do the fucking impossible. We need to be out there doing shit that sounds fucking whack dry. It sounds whack-a-doodle. I mean, what is
AP Andy
of New York?
AP Andy, what is your position on the Fidel's ethics of violence?
I mean, I guess I'd have to read explicitly what you're referencing, but when Castro was leading his guerrilla war, he wasn't exactly a leftist. He was something of a populist.
Sure.
He didn't become, he did not become a Marxist or a communist or whatever until a few years into power as a necessity of like having international support from the Soviet Union.
What do you think about the proposition that the revolutionary left's like power, its fundamental like appeal comes from its ethical supremacy?
I mean, I'm skeptical of that, to be honest.
Yeah, me too.
Are you skeptical of the ethical appeal?
Yeah, because I don't think the left is necessarily more ethical than the average worker, and
And I don't think that like the realm of ethics is a particularly fruitful terrain on which to struggle. I think that it actually like very much matches with a sort of like progressivist like popular front politics popular in the United States, where like you vote for the good guy. You know, that Donald Trump is like you know, ethically unsound, and that anyone that votes for him is then like morally outside of the moral community. I feel like if you go down that road, you end up really alienating more people than you bring in. But
well, that's part of the whole New Popular Front also, is this idea that there's an ethical responsibility to support the Republican factions against the fascist factions. And like, I have a little boy who's 3 years old, right? And he's starting to like read all different kinds of books, and he's interested in different conceptions like knights and stuff like this, right? And so when I take him to May Day and all the subsequent marches, I point to the guys wearing the red, you know, CGT vests. I'm like, these are the Knights of Labor. These are the Knights of today, right? And I think there is actually, now this is where I'm going to disagree with the Antifada podcast. I think there is a power in the ethical appeal of saying, these are the people who are representing an ethical pole that everyone should support, everybody of goodwill should support. And it's almost pre-political. It's saying like, are you on the side of the Waffen-SS or not? And you can critique me as, you know, engaging in a kind of ideological mystification and blah, 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 blah. Sure, critique me on that. But I do think there's a power in a union, you know.
What I would suggest to you, and let's close it out on this, is I would love to hear you and Derek Vaughn talk for a couple hours. Oh, you should go on his show. I'm going
to
text him.
I have no idea who is Derek Vaughn, but I'm willing to talk to anybody.
You guys would be great together. You'd have great fucking energy, and you'd like be able to go back and forth on these big philosophical and ethical questions that, honestly, I'm not like a philosophy guy. I'm like a history dude, if anything. So, check out Henry J. Wallace on Vaughn Vlog sometime soon.
And check out his Forms podcast, and hopefully your article will be out by the time we publish this, and then it'll be in the show notes. Thank you.
Yeah, you put in the show notes. Thank you, everybody. Ciao, ciao.
Yeah. Bonsoir.
Bonsoir. Sont justifiés pour avoir porté le badge puis choisi le blanc. Se justifie pour ceux qui sont morts pour avoir porté le badge puis choisi le blanc. Ceux qui sont morts sont justifiés pour avoir porté un badge puis choisi le blanc. Se justifie pour le monde qui sont morts pour avoir porté un badge puis choisi le blanc.